From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Lauren Speranza. She is director of the Transatlantic Defense and Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis, or CEPA. According to the CEPA website, Lauren works with the U.S. government, NATO allies, and partner governments to inform transatlantic security policy. She leads CEPA's Defense Tech Initiative. Her expertise includes defense and deterrence in Europe, emerging defense technologies, Russian and Chinese hybrid threats, and the future of NATO. She has also written extensively on NATO-EU relations, as well as Nordic, Baltic, Black Sea, and Mediterranean security. We will get a readout from Lauren on the significance and results of U.S. President Joe Biden's trip to Brussels for a special NATO meeting aimed at defusing the conflict in Ukraine. Prior to joining CEPA, Lauren was deputy director of the Transatlantic Security Initiative at the Atlantic Council. In this capacity, she played a leading role in managing NATO's official public diplomacy efforts. In her previous posts, Lauren worked with many entities dealing with U.S. foreign policy, such as the U.S. Consulate in Milan and the German Marshall Fund's Brussels Forum. And my favorite part, she is originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and speaks Italian. Full disclosure, my listeners know that I am also a native of Western Pennsylvania, and I studied at the University of Pittsburgh, but unfortunately, I do not speak Italian. We will talk with Lauren Speranza about what NATO and European allies are doing to tighten and increase sanctions on Russia for its invasion of Ukraine and increase forces in the alliance's eastern flank. And Lauren Speranza joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Lauren, let's start first with getting a readout from the extraordinary NATO summit, the European Council. Talk about the significance of the summit and some of the main outcomes.
Absolutely. So this was a really important trip to Europe that President Biden was really personally passionate about taking. And I think there were a couple of main goals that he had going in. One of them was really just to keep up the show of unity among the West. I mean, the alliance has been remarkably unified so far in the face of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But of course, the longer that war wages on, the more difficult it is to keep everyone on the same page. So the first goal of this trip was to make sure that there's no return to business as usual. The second goal he really had was to commit more military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine, to figure out what else we can do to support Ukraine without escalating the war further. Another goal that he had was trying to figure out what we can do to punish Russia further, so exploring new sanctions and other things like that. And then finally was to talk with NATO allies about how do we reinforce our own force posture and our own defense strategy, especially for vulnerable allies in the eastern flank that are quite close to the war that's happening in Ukraine. So those are the goals going in. I think allies did a good job of achieving most of those goals. The kind of top line statements, if I can just quickly run through, I think the major outcomes of the NATO meeting in particular, allied leaders did agree to more support to Ukraine, anti-tank missiles, air defense, drones, cyber, also protection for chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons. So that is the kind of main support that came out for Ukraine. Of course, President Zelensky had pushed for more than that. And I think we saw a bit of frustration from him that that was all that came out of the meeting for Ukraine in particular. But the rest of the meeting was really focused on how do we reinforce allied territory. So there were some announcements about putting more forces in Eastern Europe, more jets, more ships, submarines, cyber, and a lot of conversation about how to reset NATO's long-term force posture, recognizing that we really are in a new reality. The peace has been shattered on the European continent, and now NATO has to revisit its strategy for the long haul.
Exactly. A new reality. Jens Stoltenberg said that we are in a new security reality. And before we get into the defense of Ukraine, let's talk more about that. How do you see it as a student of NATO and the European alliance? How do you see the European security architecture evolving and changing in the mid and future term as a result of this extraordinary aggression by a revisionist Russia led by Vladimir Putin. What do you see as changing? For example, Ukraine has applied for European Union membership. But how do you see the European Union changing to face this emerging threat?
So I think it's very clear that the war has fundamentally changed the European security order already. And one of the major outcomes of all of this is that while a few years ago we were talking about how NATO was perhaps obsolete or brain dead, as French President Macron called it, President Trump was quite critical of the alliance. And there were a lot of concerns that NATO was kind of losing its core and would potentially fall apart. And now NATO is more unified than ever. It has a new sense of purpose and solidarity. So I think one of the major things coming out of this is that European security is now top of the agenda. NATO is stronger than ever with more clarity of purpose. And the US, who was before kind of laser focused on China, especially when the Biden administration first came into office, now I think the Russia challenge and the European theater in particular has been made equal to the China challenge, if not perhaps more important in the short term, given the urgency of Russia starting a conventional war in the heart of Europe. So that has changed the geopolitical dynamics among allies, among the transatlantic relationship. There are some things as well that are changing within the NATO alliance, in addition to allies just being more unified about what to do. You know, NATO is also in the process of developing its new strategy, its strategic concept, which will guide it for the next decade. And before the war, I think the strategy was very forward-looking in trying to tackle new threats, things like cyber and tech and the security implications of climate change, and even the security implications of the rise of China. And allies were sort of divided about how to characterize the Russia threat. And now I think that strategy, which is supposed to come out this summer in June, is going to be revamped, essentially, to go back to basics for NATO to refocus on territorial defense. And as part of this, NATO is also, you were talking about some of the membership configurations and the potential for continued NATO enlargement. What happens to the future of Ukraine, wherever the war ends up? What about other allies that are not yet members of the European Union or of NATO? So now we're having conversations again about reaffirming, we heard allied leaders reaffirming NATO's open door policy, which essentially means any country that chooses to apply for NATO membership essentially has the right to do so. And no one else outside of the alliance or those countries should have a right to veto that, particularly not Russia. So I think we are now having these conversations, you know, this idea of European integration and of Western institutions, which were kind of losing their appeal, or there was a bit of fatigue in the run-up to the war about the value of those institutions and trust in those institutions following Brexit and all of those things. I think those trends are being reversed now, and we're seeing a consolidation of voices inside Europe.
Which is highly ironic because, of course, Vladimir Putin's objective was to weaken NATO, and he was expecting something much less than what he got. He got the opposite of what he had hoped in terms of NATO, as you said, being reinvigorated and the European allies much more united. Nonetheless, China still does pose a threat. China has pledged a long friendship and, if not a strategic alliance, something akin to that with Russia. They have not yet, as far as I know, condemned the invasion, but say with the other side of their mouth, you know, that we want stability and peace. How do you see now this alliance between China and Russia affecting the war in Ukraine, NATO and Europe? The United States have warned China not to get militarily involved, not to aid in any way Russia's aggression. How do you see the threat from China in the context of this conflict?
Well, it's a really important question. And I think watching the dynamics between Russia and China is fascinating. I don't think the two are sort of proper allies in the way that NATO allies stick together. The two kind of cooperate where it makes sense and where they have shared interests. But we've seen a pattern where neither of them is really willing to take on significant risks for the other. And so I think while China kind of band together with Russia to collectively criticize the world order and the West and trying to roll back some of those principles in their own favor, I do think now China is watching the consequences of Russia's invasion and seeing how unified the West is. And given that China's economy is much more intertwined with the West even than Russia's is, I think they are reconsidering and treading very carefully because they don't want to be a pariah in the same way that Russia is becoming. So I think they're thinking twice about what kind of support they would provide to Russia in the war in Ukraine. And some of the calls we are hearing from allied leaders are hoping that China would be some kind of mediator and actually use its economic leverage over Russia, not to provide a lifeline for it to escape sanctions, but actually to pressure it to end the war in Ukraine. And I don't know that China would go that far. I think they're kind of happy to let the whole thing burn around them and kind of take care of their own interests. But in terms of what that means for NATO and for the US and its European allies and partners, absolutely, China is still a threat in its own right. I think for Europeans, the question has been not necessarily the military threat of China in the Indo-Pacific, but actually China's security challenges that it poses inside Europe. So whether that is in cyber or in tech and innovation and intellectual property theft, with debt diplomacy or foreign malign influence and political pressure that it has been waging to try and divide allies and build its own kind of sphere of influence. And I think allies are thinking very carefully about how to tackle those challenges, to build resilience to those challenges. So there's a recognition that we can't focus on one challenge or the other. We have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time to balance both of them and to prepare for potential contingencies if they were to cooperate against the West.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Lauren Speranza. She's director of the Transatlantic Defense and Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis, a think tank based here in Washington. We're discussing decisions flowing from meetings in Brussels about strengthening the West's response to Russia's unlawful and unprovoked attack on Ukraine, which is not a member of NATO nor the European Union. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to all our Russian and Ukrainian listeners, wherever you may be. And we hope you can hear us loud and clear. If you want to hear your name or home country on the air, send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. Well, back to our special guest, Lauren Speranza, with the Center for European Policy Analysis. And Lauren, I would like to transition now to talking about something that we've heard about, Jens Stoltenberg of NATO, President Joe Biden, and others have talked about this horrible threat that looms over us with regard to a possible Russian attack using chemical, biological, or even a so-called tactical nuclear weapon, because Russia is not doing nearly as well as many had thought on the ground with an overwhelming force compared to the Ukrainians, who are really valiantly defending their territory with so much less, notwithstanding the incredible military support and training that they have received from the West. But I'd like to get your take on the fact that NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg did say that the alliance was worried about this type of an attack and that they are providing equipment and training to the Ukrainians to deal with fallout from such a possible chemical, biological, or even nuclear attack.
Yes. Well, the NATO Secretary General was quite forward-leaning on this, talking about the concerns that they do have, the evidence that they have seen on the ground, the fact that Russia has used these weapons elsewhere. We know they have the capabilities. And also the fact that Vladimir Putin has a tendency of doing what he is accusing others of preparing to do. And so we have seen that he has been trying to create a pretext by accusing Ukraine of having such biological or chemical weapons and trying to use that as a reason or as a guise for him to get involved and to use such weapons against Ukraine. And so I think there is a real possibility of that happening, and that concern is shared within NATO as well as in the United States. And so how NATO is responding to that, some of the announcements that came from the summit were that we are, as the alliance, providing equipment to Ukraine to help detect and protect against these types of weapons. NATO has activated its own CBRN defense units so that we are prepared to help address any kind of spillover that could occur from those types of attacks if they were to happen. So they're taking this seriously and really trying to think through the contingencies. But the big question is, everyone has been quite clear that that would be a real escalation on Russia's part. And the West has been so careful about not wanting to further escalate with its responses. But in some ways, I think we've been so loud about what we won't do while we're letting Putin talk about what he might do. And he's almost driving the terms of escalation in some way. And the West has been hesitant to talk publicly about what the response would be if we do see a chemical attack. Surely it will be something. Surely this will be taking things to the next level. But I think it's not clear exactly what that response will look like. But for sure, that was something that allied leaders met to discuss as part of these summits. You know, what are our potential response options?
I've heard some military analysts say that this ambiguity by the West in terms of not articulating exactly what it would do in response is perhaps a good thing. How do you see that?
I really agree with that statement. I think the West and the U.S. in particular, in my personal opinion, came out too clearly at the beginning of the war saying, you know, we will not have boots on the ground. We will not do this. We will not do that. And we drew all of these lines saying that we wouldn't intervene. And I think that undermined deterrence from the beginning. And actually, regardless of our intentions, if we would have just used ambiguity as our friend, I think that would have helped to bolster deterrence and actually keep Vladimir Putin guessing about what would trigger the West to respond. And now that we've already drawn those lines and said what we won't do, it's really difficult to get back the initiative and to reestablish that deterrence because Vladimir Putin's counting on the fact that we likely will not respond in a forceful way. So I do think it's a really great strategy to move back towards embracing this ambiguity to try and keep everyone guessing.
And of course, President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine has repeatedly pressed NATO to enforce a no-fly zone over Ukraine. That's an idea that NATO has rejected, saying that it would put the alliance in a position of confrontation with Russia. But some analysts, Lauren, are advocating a limited no-fly zone. Is that even possible to protect Ukrainians from the bombings from the sky that Russians are increasingly relying upon? What's your view about that particular defense?
Well, I fully embrace those who are trying to find creative solutions to provide support to the people of Ukraine. I mean, the biggest challenge here, you can see the agony in leaders' eyes when they want to do more. There's a moral imperative to stop the slaughter of innocent civilians, but there's also a balance of not trying to escalate the war further. And so this call for kind of limited no-fly zone or humanitarian no-fly zone, which is essentially a limited version of U.S. trying to establish a particular zone where you're not necessarily going in with rules of engagement that would allow NATO pilots to shoot down Russian pilots. The idea is just you're going in to secure certain airspace to protect a limited zone so that there's no conflict. But the problem with that is even if we can control our behavior and we set the rules and the terms of engagement for the Western forces that are there, knowing that we will abide by those, we have no control over how Russia will behave and whether Russia will violate those rules or interfere. So it just opens up a lot of opportunities for risk. You know, what happens if we go up with the intention of just securing a zone but not going after or shooting anything from Russia, but a Russian pilot comes too close to the no-fly zone or enters and doesn't leave when it's escorted, you know, that opens up room for human error. It puts a lot of pressure on individual forces that are on the ground, and there's just a lot of room for miscalculation and miscommunication that could quickly turn this more violent and more bloody. So while it's a good idea in principle, and I think there are creative ways to try and do that, it really depends on how Russia would respond. And unfortunately, that's something we have no control over.
And it's always difficult when you have, you know, one side that is following the laws of war or trying, of course, to obey the constraints vis-a-vis civilians, and another side that clearly, that is the Russians under Vladimir Putin, has no compunction, as we saw, even vis-a-vis his own citizens. He has used Novichok, poison. This is the asymmetrical aspect of this particular war. Let me now turn to the sanctions Lauren Speranza, the increased sanctions on Russia, whether vis-a-vis the parliament, the Duma. Do you think that they are working and will work in the long run? You know, President Biden talks about, well, we haven't been able to deter per se Vladimir Putin, but nonetheless, these sanctions are squeezing the economy, everything to do with fueling the arsenal for war. What is your take on the impact of the sanctions? Are they having the intended effect?
As you said, I think the sanctions have not had a deterrent effect, and we've heard some conflicting messaging coming out of the U.S. administration about the intent of these, but the reality is that the sanctions weren't implemented as a deterrent. They were implemented as a response to something. So we didn't deter Putin from acting initially. The idea is to punish, and that hopefully in the longer term, that will change his calculus and shape his decision making about how long this can really go on and push him to eventually end his unprovoked and unjustified war in Ukraine. I do think the sanctions are biting. They have been implemented swiftly. Allies have shown remarkable solidarity in their ability to quickly kind of get these sanctions off the ground. And some things that we thought, frankly, most analysts thought would never happen. All allies agreeing to kick Russia out of SWIFT, Germany banning Nord Stream 2, seizing central bank assets. These are things that really, I think, were surprising to a lot of folks in the West that allies were able to get broadly on the same page. So I do think that has a real effect. And unfortunately, it just takes a long time, I think, for these to really have their full effect. And we're already starting to see some of that, but we won't see the full impact of the sanctions until a bit later on. But it's true that they already are starting to isolate Russia. Essentially, we're having Russia being isolated from the world economy already in just 4 weeks since the invasion began. So many Western businesses are closing their operations in Russia, and all of this is already starting to have an effect. We saw Putin demanding that gas be paid for in rubles from countries abroad because the ruble has fallen so drastically. And clearly, yes, of course, Putin tried to take steps to prevent this, to have stockpiles of foreign currency, knowing that sanctions would very likely be a consequence of his actions in Ukraine. But I don't think he's been able to become sanctions proof in the way that we kind of thought might happen. And I think it'll be a lot more difficult for him to ride this out in the long term.
In that regard, let's turn back to China briefly. Russia may not be sanctions proof, but to what extent are you and others worried that China could help Russia evade sanctions, you know, circumvent the sanctions? And if so, what type of punishment would China face from the West?
So I think China, again, is watching very closely the punishment that Russia is suffering as a part of its actions in Ukraine. And President Biden and others have warned China about the consequences it would face. Of course, they haven't been very public specifically about what those consequences would be if China were to provide Russia assistance for the war, whether that's economic assistance or actually military assistance. And again, I think that's purposeful because we do want that to be a deterrent for China. We don't want to show all of our cards at once. And so part of the play here is to keep China guessing and hoping that they would assume the West would respond with the same swift isolation that we imposed on Russia out of this. And so given that China is much more intertwined economically with the West, I think they're hesitant to provide such assistance to Russia. I don't think it's really in their immediate interest to throw Russia a lifeline, given the impacts it would have on its own economy. And so I think China's not likely to go out of its way to help Russia, but it's also not going to go out of its way to stand up to Russia or to go against Russia. You know, Xi Jinping has spent many years building a political relationship and rapport with Putin and building trust between the two. So I don't think he's going to be eager to throw that away. So I think they will walk this fine line of, you know, not going too far to trigger a response from the U.S. and the West from helping Russia, but also not obeying U.S. calls for them to put pressure on Russia to end the war.
Well, as we've talked about, Lauren, the sanctions against Russia, you know, haven't necessarily deterred him, but they have certainly raised the costs of this aggression against Ukraine and the West. But what about cyber attacks, not just imposing sanctions and reacting and punishing, but the West, NATO, the European Union, etc., have to tried to preempt. So are you concerned about a potential cyber attack, a debilitating cyber attack on the United States or the West from Russia in the coming days or weeks?
One thing that you just raised that we didn't talk too much about it was that I think the sanctions have actually made it very difficult for Russia to sustain this war. We are starting to see that because it is not going militarily how Russia would have hoped on the ground in Ukraine, it's also increasingly difficult for Russia to continue resupplying, and certainly will be difficult for them to rebuild or, you know, maintain the infrastructure and all of those things that would come as the invasion continues. And by that same logic, Russia also doesn't really have a ton of bandwidth and resources to open what is essentially a new front that would be a major cyber attack. I mean, they are focused really on trying to make progress on the ground, and they are not doing so well. So I think adding the cyber element would perhaps drain other resources and attention that they really don't have to spare right now. That being said, we do know that Russia is quite capable of major cyber attacks, and it's leveraged these against not just Ukraine, where they had many examples of knocking out critical infrastructure, but also against NATO allies, thinking back to the attacks that Russia orchestrated against Estonia, for example. So the alliance is right to prepare for these kinds of things. And the cyber attacks is an element that has been missing so far from the war in Ukraine that many analysts expected to see. But again, I think they have not gone that route because they have been so focused on the actual ground game because it has been so resource intensive unexpectedly. So yes, we heard allied leaders talking about giving cybersecurity assistance and cyber defense equipment and help and training to Ukraine. And also part of NATO's own posture, which was announced at the summit, was that the alliance is going to increase its own cyber defenses. So these are smart steps, because I do think that the possibility of cyber attacks is very real. But again, we haven't seen that yet, because I just think Russia has got its hands full and perhaps has bitten off more than it can chew in Ukraine.
And Lauren, another result from the meeting, the NATO meeting, is that they would accelerate their commitment, the members, to invest at least 2% of their national budgets on the alliance. And that would allow for strengthening of its longer term defense and deterrence posture. What are you hearing from the Baltic states or other frontline states on the eastern flank, you know, Romania and Poland, where President Biden was visiting over the weekend to show solidarity with what the Poles have done with respect to taking in so many more than 2 million refugees fleeing the violence from Ukraine? What are you hearing from them? Are they satisfied with the commitments by NATO?
Well, the Baltic states and Poland and even Romania and Bulgaria, a bit further down the eastern flank, they have been relatively clear-eyed about the Russian challenge for so long, and particularly the Poles and the Balts. I think their concerns about Russia were sort of poo-pooed by many Western Europeans and also to some extent by the U.S. as a bit of paranoia. But now their threat perception is being taken much more seriously. And there's a recognition that this threat was there all along, and that they have been already doing a lot, those countries in the East, to bolster their own defense spending over the last few years. Nearly all of them have raised their defense commitments. Some of them are even already above the 2% of GDP benchmark for NATO allies to try and spend that by 2024. So at the summit, one of the things that came out where allies were tasked to basically submit new plans for how they're going to reach those goals in time for 2024. And many allies are already ahead of the curve, especially in the East. There are a lot of announcements of new defense spending, and perhaps the most significant of those announcements came from Germany, which really overturned decades of policy overnight to increase their defense spending and to try and meet the 2% benchmark relatively quickly. I think the Eastern allies are happy that they are continuing to get reinforcements inside their territory. I mean, some of the other things that came out of the NATO meeting were the establishment of 4 new battle groups that will deploy to Romania, Bulgaria, Slovakia, and Hungary, and that complements the 4 battle groups that are already in the 3 Baltic states and Poland. So we now have these 8 battle groups extending from the Baltic Sea down to the Black Sea that's really enforcing that eastern flank. And now it's my understanding that the U.S. is also considering perhaps some more permanent force posture presence in the eastern flank, which is something that the Balts and Poland have long called for. But I think that that's a real possibility that we might see a permanent presence in the East in the coming months.
Lauren Speranza is director of the Transatlantic Defense and Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Lauren, thank you so much for your time and extraordinary analysis.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.